Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, Paul, is that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3 month plan, I thought, what's the catch?
Yeah, but after talking to them, it all made sense, right? Because there isn't one!
You got me!
Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. Correct me if I'm wrong, Matt.
You are right, my friend.
And they cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you and to all their users.
I'm living in a cell phone dead zone, but not anymore thanks to Mint Mobile. You can say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages.
Because Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with a premium wireless plan starting at $15 a month.
All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network.
Uh-huh, and you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number. Isn't that convenient? Along with all your existing contacts.
Ditch those overpriced wirelesses with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month.
Yeah, so to get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's my last name, R-U-S-T.
That's mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's your last name, R-U-S-T.
So cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's me.
New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. I just want to say as we close this ad out, there were no edits. We nailed this.
Nailed it.
It's like we were on a Mint Mobile phone call.
Beautiful.
I don't like blood and guts, but I love them when they're lengthily discussed. Cause nothing's more relaxing than the cries of death and lust. So spend a
today, we have the major honor of having our guest, Lee Unkrich, here. Listeners will most certainly know Lee for his astonishing work as a filmmaker at Pixar Animation Studios. He was the co-director of Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., and Finding Nemo, as well as the director of the already classics Toy Story 3 and Coco. He's also the co-author of a breathtaking new book from Toshin, about the making of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining that Matt Gourley and I here love and adore and are obsessed about, just like Jack Torrance with the scrapbook. We are so thrilled to have him here today. Please welcome to the show, Lee Unkrich.
Yay. Hey, it's so great to be here, guys. I'm a big fan of your show, and I've already been listening to your Shining episode, and so I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here, and we left out one of your major points in your bio, and that you are responsible for, I'd say, 90% of my daughter's happiness. I can't tell you how many times we've watched your films in this house, pre and post Glenn Gourley.
Someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
So, well, and the praise doesn't have to just end with the intro. Lee, we are big, movie buffs over here, and you have the rare distinction of making the only part three that is as good or better than the original. Film fans can't even name one.
I know, we've been talking about that.
Imagine the pressure I felt while I was making that movie.
Well, can you tell us what was that pressure
like? What was that like?
I'm not exaggerating that most mornings my alarm would go off and the first thing I felt like doing was like rolling to the side and vomiting over the side of my bed.
Oh my God, I can't imagine. I can't. Not only that, the pressure to kind of deliver on what has already been brought, but you know, that movie kind of goes in places that the others didn't. So did that feel like a risk as in itself, that kind of story arc?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, each of us as filmmakers have our own taste at the studio, and my taste can run a bit dark. I was always, always within the guardrails of, what we knew we were making. But especially with the Toy Story films, I mean, I always feel like there are two stories running in those films. There's a story that kids can get and enjoy and have a great time. And there's also a whole other layer, again, in those films specifically, that adults really relate to. I mean, they're about being a kid as much as they are about being an adult and going through life and all of the different kinds of things we face in the course of life. So, it's interesting to look at those three, at least the first three Toy Story films. We made the first one when we were all in our 20s.
Oh my God.
And most of us didn't have kids yet. And, by the time we get to three, a lot of us had sent kids off to college. I hadn't yet by the time I made that film, but I have now sent all my kids to college. So the films are almost like kind of markers of kind of what we were going through in life, over time.
And then in terms of Coco, which is just like, oh my God, truly an astonishing movie and has a scene that like, it's like is on the rare list of movies like Rocky or E.T. where you can just either watch the full movie, bawl your eyes out, or drop into the moment before the last scene and still bawl your eyes out. I'm just curious because Coco is about the afterlife. Before we get into the book and everything, what did The Shining mean to you as you were working on Coco? And it's sort of about spirits, ghosts, afterlife, questions of what happens to you after you die. Also that makes you cry at the end and feel connected to those who've come before you. Whereas The Shining terrifies you.
Well, I wasn't which one you meant.
Or even leaves you cold.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know that I thought about The Shining too much while I was making Coco from a spiritual or kind of afterlife perspective. But I mean, it's certainly The Shining has had an influence on everything that I've made from a filmmaking perspective. It's interesting. Like I've always loved horror films. Like when I was in high school, my friends and I, it's all we did is watch horror movies and slasher films. And I was so into all that. And once I started having my career, it was kind of unending that people would interview me and not understand why someone who loves The Shining so much can be making these family films. And I mean, in my mind, everything cohabitates. It's like one big soup in there and everything influences the other things. I mean, if I was only watching family films, I would be really worried for myself.
Yeah, that's creepier than just watching horror films to me. A grown adult watching just family films over horror films.
It would just be weird. Yeah. So there's no confusion in my mind. I mean, I love all kinds of different films and some are family friendly and some aren't.
What horror movies, were you digging before you saw The Shining, or what were you watching with buddies?
I actually wasn't really watching scary stuff before The Shining because I saw The Shining when I was 12.
Okay.
I saw it in theaters when it came out.
Oh, wow.
And I was surprised my mom took me. I mentioned this in the foreword to the book because like a year or two earlier, she had taken me to see a movie called It Lives Again, which was the sequel to It's Alive, the Larry Cohen film. I remember being terrified by the commercial for It's Alive, but I just wasn't old enough to see it.
The and poster the too, with the little hook hand. That
right?
That just chilled.
I mean, I even had the novelization of it. So when the sequel came out, I begged my mom to take me, and she did. And it was the biggest mistake she ever made in her life, because it led literally to a year of nonstop nightmares every night. It was like the most traumatic event of my childhood. So when The Shining happened, I was really surprised that she took me. And I don't even remember wanting to go or how I even became aware of it. It may have been that my mom knew that it was a new Kubrick film. I don't even know. Honestly, we just ended up at the mall watching The Shining one night. And I do remember the only thing I remember about the screening is my mom turning to me and asking me if I was okay.
Wow. And at what point, though? That's what I'm curious.
I don't know.
Like
5 minutes
in or blood elevator?
I wish I had more stories to tell about that first screening, because I don't really remember it. All I know is that I felt the beginnings of it like worming into my psyche. Wow. And it was a few days later that I saw the movie tie-in edition of Stephen King's novel on a book rack at a gas station, and I bought it. And that was the beginning of me going down this, you know, 40 plus year wormhole.
Yeah. So then how did it, what was your next watch of The Shining? Were you older? Was it, how did it unfold for you? Your obsession with The Shining?
Well, I couldn't see it again for a while. Because of course this was like the beginning of the home video industry, and we had a Betamax player. And so I waited patiently for The Shining. I waited patiently for The Shining to come out. But when it first came out, you know, the studios were still figuring out the whole rental business. And so Warner Brothers was releasing titles that were for rental only, meaning only rental stores could buy them for like $150 bucks or something.
I remember those.
And then they would rent them to people. So I couldn't buy it, but I did start renting it, and I rented it again and again, and I was showing it to my friends. And then eventually they brought out a for sale edition, which I then picked up. So I don't know. I was watching the movie again and again. I really loved it. It was rapidly becoming my favorite film. But in terms of an obsession, what happened was in my novel, in the Stephen King novel, the movie tie-in edition that had Saul Bass's art on the cover, there was a section of photos in the middle. And I noticed at some point that one of the photos was a scene that I didn't remember being in the movie. It was this shot of Wendy cooking breakfast in the kitchen. And I was like, wait a minute. And I went back to the movie and I scrubbed all over and there was no scene. So that was the first inkling of, wow, if there was a scene that he shot, that Kubrick shot, that wasn't in the film, were there others? And I sometime around the same time learned about the hospital epilogue that had been excised right after the initial limited release. And so that's really the beginning of what I can remember being my obsession of trying to track down early screenplays or anything. And there was almost nothing to be had because Kubrick held such tight reins over just about everything.
I love that.
Do you realize that little tickle of interest that you got as a young boy, you have paid that back 100-fold to Shining fans? Seriously, like to what?
I know.
I mean, oh my gosh, with the book. Look, I've read lots of making of books. It is hands down, the best. The paragraphs read, there's always three tidbits in a paragraph that I've never heard before.
Yeah, I showed him this picture of my book. Yeah,
it is like breathless to read it. You're just like, and what's so badass is you have, it's so rich in information. You're not even taking the time to bring up the myths. You're just dispelling the myths with the information. You're like, this is why they switched the typewriter. This is how Stanley Kubrick discovered the book. And my jaw is just like dropping at new information.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's one of those rare books that's 1,000 pages and you wish it was 2,000 more.
It reminds me of like a doctoral dissertation that's peer reviewed, but not boring. You know what I mean?
And also very readable.
Yeah, that's
right?
What I mean.
Yes,
yeah.
Without a doubt.
Jonathan, my partner on this project is J.W. Rinzler, who any movie buff knows from all the great work that he did. And Jonathan sadly passed away before we finished the project. But he did get the entire book written. And we just had a great partnership. I just fed him information after information and interview after interview, and he did the heavy lifting of collating everything into that text, and just did a beautiful, beautiful job.
What was he like as a person and a man? I love his work. So
Jonathan is very he was very quiet. Mm-hmm. Or not, maybe not quiet, maybe more, I would say, reserved and understated, but he was very passionate about what he did and like very, very passionate. He cared very much about it and worked really, really hard. But he wasn't like a big personality. Not that he needs to be. I mean, he's a writer, so he's locking himself away and doing the work.
Because the work you were doing, Lee, is like you were doing the legwork, getting out there.
I did. Well, I, you know, there were so many times I felt like that guy in the basement in movies who has like the single bare bulb and the and the pictures and the maps and the strings going everywhere.
Yeah, I wanted to
ask you
about
that. That was basically my life for 10 years.
Did you have a room dedicated to this? And did you just do this when you had the time, or did you take breaks from other work to really hunker down and handle this?
I did have a room in here.
Oh my God. Room 237.
That dark basement with the single bare bulb is in here.
Oh God.
I don't know. I just remember everything, just about everything. Every once in a while, I'd have to like cross check something, but that was really valuable because sometimes I would hear a story, but I would have no proof and I would file it away. And then a photo would appear and I'd go, oh my God, that's that. That makes sense. That's a fact now that we can put in the book with visual corroboration. I'm glad you brought up the whole thing about the myths, because I am driven crazy almost on a daily basis by, I have a standing search on The Shining on Google. And it feels like almost every day there's some clickbait article about The Shining or Shelley Duvall or Kubrick or something. And it's all wrong. Like it's like none of it's factual. And each of those articles uses the previous one as their primary source material. So, and these stories just get, I've watched over a decade, these stories get more and more exaggerated. So I did need to deal with that in the book, but yes, you're right. Rather than like have a list of all this misinformation and then dispel it, I just tried to mostly just state the facts. And I knew that the facts were dispelling the rumors. There were a couple of times I couldn't resist. And I would say something like, despite popular wisdom on the internet, you know, as a preface to discussing, say, the reality of how many takes Kubrick actually shot and what those scenes were. But I don't know. I'm rambling here and you're asking a bunch of questions, so I'm having trouble keeping track.
We're asking so many questions and a flurry of questions. Just that's kind of when we get excited, we ask about something. Because case in point, you mentioned the myth of the takes. Matt and I discussed it, and it was interesting. We felt like, you know, the myth before was Stanley Kubrick has something in his mind that he specifically wants, and he's doing all these takes to get everybody the thing he has in his mind. And reading it now, this book, it's what any artist likes. Options. He doesn't want to be in an editing room and not have this thing that he, what was your viewpoint on it?
Well, I think it's partially about options, but I think it might have been even more so that he claimed that he did as many takes as he sometimes did because the actors didn't know their lines. And that was true in many regards. The scenes, some of the scenes with the highest takes on The Shining were scenes with Scatman Crothers where he had big speeches and he just didn't know them well. In Stanley's mind, knowing your lines wasn't just knowing your lines. It was knowing them so well that you didn't have to think about them. And Matthew Modine talks about this in his Full Metal Jacket diaries as well, that Stanley's frustration with people not knowing their lines. Only he felt like that's your job. Your job is to show up and know your lines inside and out. And he would be frustrated when he could feel that the actors weren't really completely prepared. But I think maybe the bigger thing reason that I think Stanley would do a bunch of takes when he did is that he was always on a quest for something interesting and different. He didn't want to feel like he was repeating himself. He didn't want to feel like he was doing something that had been done before. I think he found often, especially with Nicholson, that the deeper he got into the takes, Jack would start like being like, I don't know what you want anymore, but I'll do this all day and let's do something weird. And those were often the takes that Stanley went with because they were just odd. You know, Kubrick's criticized sometimes for Jack's performance being so, I don't know, it's described as over the top or unrealistic. And I think that's exactly what he was going for. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what was interesting to him. That's really what it comes down to, is Stanley wanted something to be interesting.
Mm-hmm. I read
and
that.
If it wasn't interesting, he would keep going.
I read that about George C. Scott, too, in his takes for Buck Turgidson and that in Dr. Strangelove, and that at the end, they'd basically, he'd say, like, give me one that's just a cartoon. And they would do that, and he would typically use those takes. I don't know if that's just apocryphal or what, but it seems
right. I love the story in the book that I think Joe Turkle was quoted as talking about when they were shooting the bar scene that Jack really went over the top for one take and was just like every other word out of his mouth was him swearing, and it was like completely unusable. And I always loved when stories like that came up because I hadn't heard that one before. Like I had done so much research and had read so many interviews. I always knew when people were telling me the same stories they always told in interviews. And so I would always dig deeper
and try to get
different things out of them. And one of the ways I was able to do that, at least with the people that I met with in person, is at a certain point I had amassed so many photographs that nobody had ever seen before. And you know, from looking at the book, like 80% of the photos in that book had not been published before. Yeah. And I found that when I showed photos to people, they would spark memories. You know, instead of just dropping into the needle drop of how I always answer questions about The Shining, they could tell me a story like, oh, you know who that is? That's Werner Herzog. He was on the set that day. And like, so these stories would bubble up. And I always knew immediately if I was hearing something that was completely brand new.
I want to ask about your just setting off on this quest. So this is such well-traveled material, but not really traveled well, if that makes sense. And you must have known from the beginning that you're heading out on a quest where there's all kinds of stories and trivia, but the richness of footage and the wealth of all that extra footage is gone. So was there kind of like an emotional...
Gone-ish.
Yeah, right. I guess so.
Because I have a lot of images in that book.
Oh, do
yeah,
you?
But I'm talking actual frames from alternate takes and scenes that Kubrick had cut that nobody even knew existed.
But on a typical film, you could maybe get access to the vaults and see these alternate takes, but all the moving images of this are gone. And that's like
true.
Emotionally got to be, you must have to wrestle with that at some point. I don't know.
No, I mean, just the fact that I even had stills, I counted, you know, I was thrilled to even have that.
Right.
And, you know, and I spent a lot of time with Stanley's assistant, beloved assistant, Leon Vitali. And, you know, Leon told me firsthand about the day he went and burned all the outtakes for the films. And, you know, but he's able to explain to me why Stanley did that and why he wanted him to. And I'm like, well, it makes sense. I mean, Stanley was smart. You know, when he died, there were such a thing as DVDs, and he saw it was all heading. He saw all these kind of quote-unquote director's cuts coming out, and he basically said, you know, after I die, I don't want people putting scenes back in my movies that I don't want in them and then calling it a director's cut. Like, the film is the film, and he could remove temptation from anyone doing that after he was gone by just destroying all of it, which he did.
So you mentioned you had this access to Leon Vitali, also Jan Harlan. And
wait a minute, I'm sorry to interrupt. You just said most of it with a wink. Do you know something we don't
know? Just the fact that I did uncover these little snippets
of these
scenes that I was able to use stills from in the book.
Okay, sorry, Paul.
Oh, no. you mentioned, you had this amazing access to people involved with the Kubrick estate as... You know, you said you were giving this information to Jonathan Rinzler. Can you tell us about the process of getting involved with the estate and how you went about getting them to
share? Well, to go way back, it all started with, you know, I was just once the internet became a thing, I started searching. I would look for anything having to do with The Shining, and I would find little things here and there. I'd find an image I hadn't seen, but it was pretty anemic. And I would just file this stuff away in folders on my computer. And then when blogging started to become a thing, I thought, you know what, I'm going to put all the stuff I have out online. I start a blog, and maybe there's one other person out there who loves The Shining as much as I do, and they'll reap the benefits of it. And so I did that. I brought out the site, overlookhotel.com. And at some point I thought, I wonder if anything is going to come my way because I put this out into the world. And then that started to happen. I would have people send me stuff to for the blog or just for me. And then I started to hear from a couple of people who actually worked on the movie and, you know, had conversations with them. And the more, you know, after a couple of decades of really having almost no information, I was starting to get more and more coming in, and it was really thrilling for me. And then after Stanley died, after a period of time, the family donated, you know, all of his archives to the London College of Communication. And around the same time, they started this traveling Kubrick show, which is still touring the world. And so when I was finishing up Toy Story 3, I knew I was going to be going to London to do press. And so I reached out to Richard Daniels, who at the time was the chief archivist at the archive, and I arranged to go visit it. I tacked on a few extra days at the end of my press tour, and I sat in the archive for like 3 days, and I still have all my notes from that time, and my head just like exploded at all the things that I saw that were there. And so it was around then that I started thinking, well, maybe there's a book here, because a lot of people had written about The Shining in terms of what it means and, you know, interpretation, critical analysis, but there was very little about the actual making of the film. And that's what I was really interested in. And so I reached out via the archive. I reached out to Jan Harlan and pitched the idea for a book, pitched myself as a filmmaker making the book, which I knew would help grease the wheels. And it did. He was very excited about it, but he wanted to see an actual proposal of what I wanted to do. And so I sat on it for a while to think about it. And during the time I was thinking about it, many months later, one of the attorneys from the Kubrick estate got in touch with me and said, hey, just to let you know, we've been approached by someone else who wants to do a book on the making of The Shining. Oh. And I was like, oh, man. Yeah, it's the bat, like 40 years later. And so I did some sleuthing, and I found out that the other person was Jonathan Rinzler. And he was working with a partner he sometimes worked with named Brandon Allinger. And so I got in touch with Jonathan, and it turns out he lived in the Bay Area, which is where I live. And so I invited him to Pixar for lunch. We had a great lunch. We realized that it was, well, A, we couldn't both do books. The estate was only going to support one. Mm-hmm. So we decided to join forces. And I knew a ton about the movie, but had never written a book. And Jonathan had written many books, but was kind of at square one with doing research. So it was kind of, we knew it would be a perfect partnership. And so Jan was thrilled because he didn't want to have to pick. And off we went. And it was many years before Tashin was involved. We always wanted to work with Tashin, but it was quite a few years. I ended up totally self-financing the writing of the book for a period of time until Tashin was on board.
Oh, wow. And that lined up nicely because they had been doing these Tashin collection, Stanley right. Kubrick affiliated.
Exactly.
So then word, you're being modest, but word gets around quickly that you're not a shithead and you make good stuff. And so what happens then? It's like, who's the person who kind of says Lee's good to talk to? He's not going to mess this up or, and then what doors does that open to?
Oh, in terms of like interviews?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so the number one thing that I knew I had to do was track people down because nobody was getting any younger and several people had passed away already who worked on the film, some of the key creatives. So I really put all my energy into finding people and some of it took years to find. I mean, it was years before I finally tracked down Shelley Duvall and was able to talk to her.
Do you mean getting in contact with her or literally tracking her down?
Literally finding her.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And it took me a long time to find Danny. I was literally, like, I knew he was teaching biology at a community college in Kentucky. Like, I had that one little tidbit. So I was literally at websites for colleges in Kentucky going through faculty rosters. And I finally found him. And I wrote him. And then I didn't even hear back for a long time. And then he finally wrote back. And he was very cagey because everyone was protective of Stanley. Even after Stanley's gone, just about everyone is still very protective of him and the fact that Stanley wouldn't have wanted any of them talking about anything. But I put Jan in touch with Dan, and that kind of Dan then opened up because he knew it was an officially sanctioned project. And that was kind of true for everyone. I mean, once I would have a cover letter I would always send explaining my pedigree and that this book was supported by Warner Brothers and the Kubrick estate. And that pretty much did the trick for just about everybody. And when it didn't, I would get Jan involved to make a phone call or send an email.
Is there anybody that you wanted that you couldn't get, if you can say?
I didn't talk to Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Right. And it wasn't for lack of trying. Mm. I mean, at the highest levels. Mm-hmm. But Jack famously during his career didn't do interviews unless they were in conjunction with doing promotion for a film. Mm-hmm. They were very rare that he would do interviews. But I really wasn't worried. I would have liked to have met Jack, and I know he has the book now. We sent him a few copies. But I knew that the material I had was going to suffice because Vivian Kubrick, Stanley's daughter, made a documentary about the making of The Shining, which is on the Blu-ray. And I got a hold of all of her footage of the interviews that she had done with the cast members.
Oh, wow.
So that was in the archive. So I was given permission to have that. So I had these full unedited interviews and the transcripts of them. And Jack gave like a 2-hour interview on his last day of filming.
Oh, that's where you got that. That's awesome. Wow.
So, and then Jack also gave an interview maybe, I don't know, 8-10 years ago to Empire Magazine as a favor to Steven Spielberg, who was guest editing that issue, to talk about The Shining. And I got a hold of that whole transcript as well and had long conversations with the journalist, Nev Pierce, who wrote that. Between the two and then other tidbits over the years, little bits and bobs, I knew that he would be as well represented as anybody else and completely sufficiently. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel like other than not being able to talk to Stanley, who never would have talked to me, I feel like I got everyone.
With Crawley and Rust.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, Paul, is that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch?
Yeah, but after talking to them, it all made sense, right? Because there isn't one!
You got me!
Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. Correct me if I'm wrong, Matt.
You are right, my friend.
And they cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you and to all their users.
I'm living in a cell phone dead zone, but not anymore thanks to Mint Mobile. You can say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages.
Because Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with a premium wireless plan starting at $15 a month.
All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network.
Uh-huh. And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number. Isn't that convenient? Along with all your existing contacts.
Ditch those overpriced wirelesses with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month.
Yeah, so to get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's my last name, R-U-S-T.
That's mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's your last name, R-U-S-T.
So cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's me.
New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. I just want to say, as we close this ad out, there were no edits. We nailed this.
We nailed it.
It's like we were on a Mint Mobile phone call.
Beautiful.
With Corley and Rust.
Did you feel like you had any eureka moments or just moments of utter surprise that you didn't expect when you found something?
Well, yeah. I mean, there were plenty of stories that I, you know, had never heard before. Or, you know, eventually Dan Lloyd, who played Danny Torrance, introduced me to his parents, who are both still living and were with him during the shoot. And I have gotten to be really good friends with them. And I went to visit them and they brought a trunk up from their basement and it was full of costumes from the movie, a bunch of Danny's costumes. And,
God, yeah.
And
this is in the book, right?
Yeah. And the mother load was that they had about 450 35 millimeter negatives that they had shot during the production that no one outside the family had seen.
Oh my God. Amazing.
And they hadn't even seen all of them because they put some in a photo album and the rest like had been forgotten. So
and they like had access because they're family on sets and it's not like right.
They weren't always there because pretty early on, they realized that they were a distraction for Danny. But certain kinds of scenes where they were outside or on a big set, they could kind of be there in the background. And so that's how I discovered, you know, like nobody could tell me where that rear projection shot of them driving up in the car. Like there was no information on the call sheets about what stage they were on or anything. And then I saw Dan's father, Jim's photos revealing that the car was set up like pretty much right where Jack's writing table was
in the
Colorado lounge.
Yeah. That photo is incredible. Yeah.
So there was a lot of stuff like that. And then on another level, in terms of surprises or biggest things I got out of it, the whole process for me really humanized Stanley and made him, you know, he's still brilliant and nothing will change that. But I also saw the very human side of him, both from personal stories I was told, but also seeing him struggle as a filmmaker and not always have the answers. You know, and there's similar stories in Matthew Modine's diary about Full Metal Jacket and Stanley not knowing how that movie was going to end even while they were in the middle of production and was always asking actors, like, why do you think it should end? You know, Stanley was always asking questions, and because you never know where a good answer is going to come from. And it didn't need to, he didn't have such, you know, I think he had an ego on him, but I think he didn't have such an ego that he felt like he needed to be an auteur and the master, storyteller. Maybe that story was told later and he didn't dispute it. But while he was making his films, he was really open to suggestions and was always having conversations with people.
His ego is interesting.
Matt, go ahead.
Well, just that I find the concept of Stanley Kubrick's ego being an interesting thing in that, yeah, he seems to have an ego, but it does seem that ego is in service of the film as opposed to some other auteurs whose ego are in service of themselves, which, I mean, by definition.
I mean, I think it's both, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, Stanley knew how people talked about him.
Uh-huh.
And what a pedestal he was put on. And he didn't do anything to dispute that. You know, he was never humble. And when he did give interviews, it was always with the understanding that he was going to be given the interview so that he could edit it. I think Stanley was afraid that he would come off as an idiot or say something stupid and regret it. So he always maintained complete over control.
He says I mean, we've all had it happen. Right?
Any of us who've been interviewed,
I do it to myself all the time.
And then you're like, why the hell did I say that?
Yeah.
What's he say? He talks about Coppola, right? He's like, really interested in Coppola's movies until he starts talking. So maybe I should just.
Well, I mean, he felt that way. So, yeah, he held pretty tight reins over his public image for sure. And he I think he carefully curated that image, and it came back to bite him, I think, in terms of The Shining. Like, I think a lot of the rumors out there about how actors were treated and what a tyrant Stanley was came because of choices he made in his daughter's film, because Stanley had final cut over that film. And I know from talking to Vivian that there were a lot of other scenes and moments in it that maybe showed Stanley in a friendlier light. But Stanley kept steering her towards stuff, scenes where he was being tough, mm-hmm. you know, or being stern, but that maybe matched the image that he knew people had of him. And now, because that's really the only visual record of Stanley working on that film, people, you know, they see a moment of Stanley snapping and being stern with Shelley, which I don't think he's being abusive at all. He's just frustrated. Everyone was crispy at the end of production when they shot that. Mm-hmm. And Shelley missed a cue, and it was a big, complicated shot. So, you know, he kind of firmly gave her a talking to, as it were.
Yeah.
And people see that and they assume that, like, that was every day on the set and that's what it was like. And it's just not, it's not true.
No, so, your book actually, it's actually a sweet notion kind of comes across in the book where it almost seems like maybe the guy was just a shy nerd who didn't mind people seeing them as tough. We're all that way.
Well, I even heard stories about him being intimidated by Jack because Jack was so charismatic and everybody loved Jack. And Shelley felt that too, honestly, because Shelley was she was young and demure and you know, she's working with these two powerhouses. But I think Stanley, I would hear stories of there being little kind of almost like pissing matches a little bit between them. Stanley going at it in an intellectual way, although Jack was also very intellectual, and Jack going at it with a charisma that Stanley, I think, could have only hoped to have had.
Yeah. And you mentioned their name. I mean, the book also just really works as these kind of, like, you get these characters of, like, yeah, Danny's family, this sweet Midwestern family that gets kind of brought up and out to another country, and you get their sort of experience in Oz, and then I'm so happy you spoke with Shelley Duvall, because there is a paragraph in there that talks about how, in the same paragraph, she would have friends visit members of Monty Python and martial artist Steven Seagal.
Yeah. You know, people talk
together again.
People talk about Shelley as if she was, like, completely abused on that movie and kept in a cage and brought out to shoot her scenes. But she was having a rich social life. She was friends with the Monty Python guys. She was dating Ringo Starr for a period of time. I mean, she was out there.
Yeah.
Not that it wasn't tough. It was a difficult shoot.
Yeah. You mentioned Vivian Kubrick, who, when you read the book, it's really impressive, the impact, influence that she seemed to have on the Shining. Can you discuss that? What was your experience like learning that information? And was that new to you? It was new to us.
Yeah. Well, some of that I got through Vivian, and then a lot of it I got through other people, you know, who knew Vivian or, you know, were with on the set with her. Vivian was very, very close to her father. And when Stanley asked Vivian to make this film, she was 17. And I think from the stories I was told, he was feeling like she was a bit adrift and didn't know where she was kind of going, what she wanted to do. She had worked for a time in the art department, I think, briefly, and she was going to quit. And Stanley said, you should make a movie. You want to make a movie? Make a movie. And so he, I think probably at that point, he maybe saw her as, I don't want to say heir apparent, but he saw her as the one person who maybe would kind of follow in his footsteps, mm-hmm. and make films herself. And she only did, you know, she shot The Shining and made that film. She also shot a documentary on Full Metal Jacket, but never edited it. Like, it was never completed.
Have you ever gotten to see any of that footage? Have word around the campfire at all that it would ever come out, the making of the film?
It all exists.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to the Stanley Kubrick exhibit, mm-hmm. In the Full Metal Jacket room, there's typically a monitor playing, showing a bunch of that footage. So A little bit of it is out there.
I like
it. And all the footage, all the footage she shot on The Shining still exists too. All the negative exists.
Yeah. Anything that wasn't in the documentary that was that you,
oh, she shot. No, it's like 80 hours of footage.
And is it, stuff just like behind, literally behind the sets, or is it,
no, she's on the set. I mean, it's, you know, a little bit of it Yan used in his, the documentary he made about Stanley, My Life in Pictures. Mm-hmm. I've seen all the camera logs. I've read through Vivian's notebook, so I know what all the footage is, and it's like unprecedented access to the entire filming of the film. Will it ever see the light of day? I don't know. I hope so. I think that while Vivian is really in control of it, and she doesn't want it seen, she firmly believes Stanley would not want it seen, and she's adamant that she doesn't want it seen. But it does exist, and you know, perhaps our children will someday be able to see it. I don't know, but I think it's vital that it be preserved for film history. You know, at a certain point, I don't know that you need to keep respecting the wishes of the artist when it comes to somebody of Stanley's magnitude and influence on cinema. Mm-hmm. I think that this footage deserves to be seen someday. Mm-hmm. And I hope I'm first in line.
I have a feeling you will be.
When I mentioned that the making of, you know, it's just the best making of book I've read, it functions as like a, oh, if you like, you know, if you love The Shining, it's a great making of book. If you love Stanley Kubrick, it's really great because I think it's just like understanding his process is amazing. But yeah, it's also just a great making of book in terms of if you love movies and want to know how different departments work in conjunction with each other, which remarkably that doesn't come up often in making of books.
I wanted everyone represented. You know, I would sometimes get some pushback about who I was talking to just because maybe they were deemed not important, but I didn't care if it was, I mean, I talked to Jack Nicholson's personal chef that was at his home with him during the shoot. I like anyone, any grip or PA, anyone who I could find, I wanted to talk to because everyone has stories.
That story about Nicholson calling his chef at like 2:30 in the morning saying, gonna throw a party right now. Get up and make a bunch of food.
Well, yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's actually that's the opening scene of Vivian's documentary. If you see the very beginning is Jack on the phone and he's on the phone with his chef, like getting that menu dialed in. Anyway, I wanted to speak to everybody because everyone has stories. And that's why I think so many making of books sound kind of the same is because they're talking to like the A-list talent and they have stories and they're important stories, but they're not complete stories. And so, I really went wide and deep with talking to people. And I think I got as thorough a telling of what actually went on day to day as could be created.
Well, particularly with the lighting, the cinematography crew, because I think that seemed to be like the secret recipe that was going on in Kubrick's movies is just like how, and they seem to be really dedicated, but also they could kind of razz the boss every once in a while. I don't know what the...
Well, Lou Bogue.
Yes.
Yeah. Lou Bogue's a real character in the book. he's still living. He's a really funny guy. Yeah, it's interesting. Like with somebody like Kubrick, most people demur to somebody like that. But Lou didn't. And I think Stanley liked when he encountered people that would talk back to him a little bit, as long as they knew their shit and like and were good at their jobs.
There's a famous piece of lore that I wonder if you found any evidence of where they were filming The Spy Who Loved Me and the set was so big for the submarine hangar. And apparently they brought in Kubrick off the record to advise with lighting that set. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Oh, that's awesome. If Ken Adams was like, buddy, need you in here.
It was Ken Adam.
Yeah, no, it's possible. That might not have been a factoid I would lock into here.
Yeah, in the room, in the headroom.
Yeah. But no, it's possible. I mean, in the book, I think I mentioned like one of the camera assistants on The Shining went on to Empire.
Yeah.
And there was some issue with getting equipment or a certain lens or something. And he called Stanley and Stanley kind of greased the wheels and made it happen for them. So there'd be things like that. Before I forget, I wanted to mention that I listened to your first episode about The Shining that you've put out. Yeah. I think it's only been one so far.
Oh, dispel our myths, please.
Yes.
No. Paul. Well, yeah, maybe you didn't get everything perfectly right, but I'm the only person in the world that would know that. But what I did want to mention is that you said something that I didn't know.
Okay.
You saw something or read something on the internet that I had never seen.
I'm dying to hear
which
what
this which is the scene where Danny gets off his trike and goes to room 237 and tries the doorknob. The fact that there's the doorway is open in the background and you can see off the set. I had never noticed that and I had never read anything about it. So of course I immediately I looked on my phone first because I have the movie on my phone and then watched it bigger. And it just shows you that when you're watching films, the filmmaker knows where your eye is meant to be and what you're meant to be looking at. And I have seen that movie God knows how many times, and I'm always watching Danny cross over to that door. And yeah, that's like blatantly wrong in the background. If that happened today, he would have digitally put a door in or something. So the question is, did he ever notice? Because he probably would have been pissed if he had noticed, and he would have been pissed at himself for not noticing. But it wasn't important enough to him. Well, he didn't start editing the movie till everybody wrapped. So it's not like he could have seen that and then gone back and, reshot it. Mm-hmm. If the editor had, maybe they didn't even see it in dailies. Yeah. I don't know. Everyone is probably just watching Danny.
Yeah. It had to be pointed out to me. And when I, online and when I saw it, it did blow my mind. And exactly. It speaks to the power of where your eye is supposed to go. And
totally.
You could have a dancing bear on the side of there and you would notice it.
And that you can have mistakes.
You can have a filleting dog and still not notice.
Mistakes happen.
You tell me what's in the background of the filleting dog and I'll give you $1 million.
Wasn't there a bottle of Avion in a scene in Game of Thrones?
Yes, there was. Yeah.
Stuff like that happens. Yeah. And I mean, even on my movies, every shot in Toy Story 3, we would watch the finished version of the shot up on a big screen looping with a theater full of people trying to catch mistakes. And yet there's still at least one glaring mistake in that movie that none of us caught. So it's an interesting group psychology thing. But I went in December, we had the book rollout in London and we had a big to-do at the Kubrick estate, which was awesome. And we had a screening of The Shining at the British Film Institute. And it was the first time that I had seen The Shining up on a big screen in quite a while. And I was watching it. And in one scene, the scene where Wendy's kind of staggering around the hotel at the end and seeing scary thing after scary thing, when she comes upon Scatman Crothers' dead body, she sees him in a wide shot. It cuts to her face, I think, and then it cuts back to the wide shot and there's a snap zoom in on Scatman laying there in a puddle of blood. And for whatever reason, that at that screening, I every other time you're looking at the blood, you're looking at the wounds on his chest, but I looked at his face and I was like, oh my God, he's blinking. And that's the take that's in the movie.
Oh my God.
And I had never noticed it. And I think it maybe took seeing it on a big screen like that, but once I saw it, now I always look there and I see Scatman going
oh, now I'm going to do that. Oh my God.
That's fantastic. Well,
so yes, it does dispel the myth of Stanley being hyper in control of every last thing and there being no mistakes in his films.
Well, with the framing, I'm curious when you mentioned the door and and what you had just seen too, but Warner Brothers, I don't know how you can hold your tongue about this or whatever, they sometimes do funky things with their home video releases. The sound designer talks about it, just saying when it went to 5.1, they sort of futzed up. But there's early controversies of the you see the helicopter shadow when it's full frame versus not. I personally love the VHS release and the original DVD 1999 release because it does have it in the full frame aspect ratio and the color, colors are the same. How does that, because there's also a tidbit sort of about Terry Semel does get to, as Warner Brothers gets to watch The Shining and have a reaction. How does that all handle in home video release? Is it just the Kubrick estate hands it over and they
No. Stanley was completely in control of everything until he died in 99. So anything prior to 99, Stanley was 100% hands-on in making decisions about the releases. And everything after he died, for a long period of time, Leon Vitale was handling with explicit instructions from Stanley about what Stanley wanted and an understanding of what Stanley wanted. All that stuff about the aspect ratio, I've seen people getting a lather over it online, but the facts are really very simple. At the time that Stanley made The Shining, he knew that The Shining was going to be seen on television. And so he didn't want it to be panned and scanned, which is something they used to do when you were moving from a widescreen aspect ratio to more of a square TV screen shape. They would actually do camera moves and framing kind of on the telecine when they were doing the film transfer. And it always looks like shit. Like nobody is happy with pan and scan. And Stanley certainly wasn't. So Stanley shot The Shining knowing that it was going to be seen theatrically and it was going to be seen on television. And his idea of television at the time was right, like a 1:3:3-ish aspect ratio. And so they shot the film 1:8:5, definitely. 1:8:5 was the aspect ratio that he wanted The Shining shot in, but he protected the full frame so that he would have access to it and there wouldn't be any mistakes and the composition would still work. You know, he kind of framed for both at the same time so that he would be as happy with the version that was shown on television and home video as it was at that time, as well as the theatrical 1:8:5. I think Stanley's ideal aspect ratio was 1:6:6. He would have loved to shoot everything in that. That to him was like the perfect aspect ratio, but it just wasn't realistic. And to think that theaters would properly use the right lenses and the right aperture gates in the projectors, it just was too much to control. And I think he realized that was a battle he wasn't going to win. And so he, I think, begrudgingly accepted 1:8:5 as a standard. And that's how he shot. But in terms of getting into the weeds on the later video releases, you know, once DVD came out, I mean, I think he definitely was involved. Like, however it was on DVD while he was alive, that was what he agreed to and was happy with. What started to get fudgy was when we started having widescreen TVs, you know, and high-def TVs, when those started to become the standard, because that aspect ratio isn't, they're not showing 1:8:5, and 1:8:5 is kind of close. So you do have little thin letterboxes. So I think they made a decision to fudge the compositions ever so slightly to accommodate that. And that's where we've kind of ended up with all the subsequent releases.
Oh, that's a great answer. Thank you. Just another dorky nuts and bolts question that I wondered. How do you think they did that summer of 42 on the TV when Wendy and Danny are watching it?
How they did it?
Yeah, like there's,
what do you mean?
There's no cables. How did they?
Well, you can tape a cable to the back of a leg and then hide it under.
All right, that's the kind of answer I was saying.
Yeah,
I mean that's what they did. He didn't want a cord there.
This is what keeps Paul up at night.
So many of the decisions that Kubrick made, and so many of the quote unquote continuity errors in The Shining and other films of his, came from the fact that all Stanley cared about was the individual compositions, the frames. If there's a lamp in the background of another shot and it's getting in the way of a composition of a different angle in the same scene, he would not hesitate to remove it.
Oh yeah, that's, you know, not a nitpicky thing. Like, how is that TV showing that? It was like what's the movie magic here? When I was a little kid, I always kind of scratched my head. I loved it.
Oh, I don't know. No, I mean, they think they hid the cord. I mean, it wasn't a process shot or anything. They just were playing it on the TV. Yeah. There's only one special effects shot in the entire movie.
Is it the maze?
No, it's, well, yeah, you could. Yes. I'm sorry. I should include that one because that was a process shot. Yes. So, but there's only one in camera effect, which is the wide shot of Jack sitting and typing.
Oh yeah, it's in your
where there's
book.
A roaring fire, and they couldn't, because the set was so bright and the film stock at the time was not fast enough to, you know, the sets had to be lit to a certain brightness. They wouldn't have gotten a good exposure on the fire in the fireplace. So they shot the whole shot without the fire burning in the fireplace. Then they backwound the film and they turned all the lights off on the set and they lit a roaring fire and then they exposed for the fire and then they exposed the same negative a second time.
That's incredible.
To end up with the shot as it is. Ugh. But yeah, I have to be careful when I say that's the only effect shot because yes, of course, the overhead shot of Danny and Wendy in the middle of the maze was definitely a composite.
Yeah, in camera, that's so fascinating. Like, not to go back to James Bond again, but when they did all their space effects, they rolled back the camera multiple times in different portions of the frame so that they didn't overlap. And they were just nervous as hell every time going, we're taking another risk, yet another risk, and we're going to lose.
Well, and it's cool. Cool because you don't have to like go down a generation and in, you know, doing an optical.
Yeah. But we always
see movies where it gets all grainy.
Yeah.
All
of a sudden, yeah.
You know, okay, there's a special effect coming up in a moment.
Yes. Or dissolve. They did it, they're potentially losing all the iterations before. And just what a time and a place to be in special effects.
And when you're
effects.
A kid, the animation equivalent is like, that drawer looks a little different there in the desk. I think they're going to open that drawer.
It's going to move. It's not part of the background painting. Yeah.
Leah, I want to ask about the design elements for the Toshin book and what that process was like and choosing what was going to go in there. Did it just present itself? Was the kind of Overlook Bible there from the beginning? And the manuscript of the All Work and No Play, what was the process like?
Yeah, describe the different components. It's pretty cool.
Sure. Well, early on, from a design perspective, as I mentioned, I really wanted to work with Tashin, but it wasn't a no-brainer. They weren't just going to accept it. I had to make a pitch. And somebody gave me some advice that I should reach out to the same designers in Paris who had done the 2001 book, which was, I think, in progress at that moment. And they had also done the Napoleon book. Mm. And so I reached out to them, to Matthias and Michael at MM Design in Paris. And they happened to be in LA. And so we had lunch at Chateau Marmont one day. And I had my laptop and showed them a lot of the stuff I'd already gathered. And they were intrigued and excited. And they came back with this notion of doing a big scrapbook. Because I had told them about the scrapbook in the movie that had been excised, and they were fascinated by this ghostly scrapbook that was still in the movie, but it wasn't part of the film. So that was their idea, to do a big oversized scrapbook and also to do a Bible. Like, they were inspired by like a Bible that you would find in a hotel nightstand. Yeah, yeah. And we knew it was going to, I told Tashin from the beginning, this is going to be unlike any book you've done. It's going to be very text heavy, and it has to be, and you need to be on board with it. Yep. And they were. Benedict never pushed back on that. So they kind of came up with this notion. And then I pushed for the ephemera box to have all the All Work and No Play pages. And it was a great place for us to tuck some other bits and bobs, like that great continuity script that I got from Vivian. Yeah. Anyway, so that design kind of stuck pretty much from the beginning. I mean, it was refined, of course, over time. But in terms of the actual content, I was naive. I'd never done a book before, and I assumed I needed to just turn everything over to them and they were going to make the book. But it became clear pretty quickly that while they were really interested in the design, in terms of the typeface and the aesthetics and the paper and like everything about the book, the actual content of the book, they really deferred to me on. And so it became a really great collaboration. I ended up choosing every photo for both the Bible and for the scrapbook, and doing all that editing. I mean, I had printouts. My kitchen was covered with images as I found pairings and kind of figured out what that book was going to be. And then the same with the Bible. I did all that editing. I mean, nobody knew the material better than me. Yeah. I knew what was special. I knew what was important. I knew what had never been seen. So it made sense for me to do all that work. And then they figured out, it was a lot of back and forth to figure out how to get the images close to where things were being talked about in the textbook. It was like a grueling process, to be honest, but it was necessary.
You know what I love about the scrapbook is it kind of honors the, the story between the lines in the movie where there's just missing photos in the scrapbook. There's the spaces.
Yeah. That was their idea, to have the clippings slowly disappearing. And the way they originally proposed it, they were going to have just like letters disappear off the articles. Uh-huh. But But I got excited and inspired by their idea. And I said, no, we got to make this, like, since the real scrapbook doesn't exist anymore, we have to make these articles and make them look real. And amazing. And when they disappear, I want them to be gone, like a picture's been taken down off the wall of an old house, yeah, and the wallpaper is not faded where the picture was. And so I took that on with their blessing. I made all of those clippings that are in that scrapbook.
Wow. You mean
book design, or you just wrote them, or all
yes.
of it? You did the whole design.
Everything. Oh, hey,
that's like yes. a book in itself. That's so crazy.
It was so fun. It was a big, long project. Wow. There were bits and bobs of remnants in the archive that I was able to make use of for some of the articles, but other ones I just had to be creative. And I, at the very end of the scrapbook, there's a vellum sheet, and I have a kind of disclaimer, as it were, where I explain that the actual scrapbook is long lost, but that I created these with the same level of verisimilitude that Stanley would have demanded. And I was like, I went all in. I even designed the backsides of the articles so that they, and because I knew they would.
Oh my God. This leads me to that question.
attention to detail. The newspapers never look fake in a Kubrick movie.
I asked you earlier how much you dedicated your time. So would you just take, I'm going to take a week's vacation and make some newspaper articles, or just whenever you had time?
I mean, I was developing and then making Coco for 7 of the years of this book project. So all I could really do was stuff on the weekends. Okay. I would do most of my interviews on like Saturday or Sunday mornings, because that would be like 4 p.m. in the UK. So that would happen. And I could just gather stuff on my own time. But when it came to making the book in earnest, I left Pixar about, I don't know, like 3 years ago now or so. And I was able to devote more full time. So stuff like the newspaper clippings and actually helping to bring the book across the finish line, I was able to devote, you know, kind of pretty much full time to helping with
that. That's incredible. It really fills my heart with joy to hear that you had your fingers in the design of it as well. I just love that kind of thing. This book,
I did. Well, and I'm grateful to MM for letting me, you know, that they, I mean, as much as they wanted to have their imprint on it and had strong feelings about the design, they equally knew that this was my baby and they wanted me to be happy with it. And they wanted me to have as much kind of control over it as I felt I needed. So it was a great collaboration.
Oh man, but not to be too grandiose, but this book is to me, the definitive book about a movie, because it's just, it's incredible.
Well, thank you. It makes me really happy to hear that. And the fact that you mentioned that, I mean, I always saw this being as a book for fans of The Shining and fans of Kubrick and just fans of filmmaking. One of the things that Jonathan Rinzler brought to this that we never really discussed, but it came out of trying to figure out where to put material, is he came up with this notion of having these sidebars all throughout the book that kind of delve a little more deeply into Kubrick and his methods and his personal life. And I love that. I love that you get these little breaths throughout the book to dive deeper into Stanley. And there's a lot of material in there that I've never read before. So I think it paints a fuller picture, perhaps, of Stanley, kind of the fullness of him in his personal life and the way he worked. I think it does. And I'd be really happy to know that it kind of brings a lot more to the table for Kubrick scholars and for people to understand who he was as a person and a filmmaker.
Yeah, I was a fan of The Shining, but I'm more of a fan of The Shining after having read this. And I say that with no exaggeration. I really loved the movie, but this book put me in a way that made me immediately, I couldn't wait to watch it again, but I wanted to save it till after I had read the book so I could just take it all in. And now I watch it in a new way that I'm so happy about, because I think I've been watching it in the same way, loving it, but now it's like kind of getting to watch a new version of the film. And I'm grateful.
Thank you. Well, Steven Spielberg gave me a quote. Steven ended up writing the foreword for the book. And he says something amazing. When I read it, my jaw dropped. He said something like, "You must read this book. And the moment you finish it, watch the movie again." He said, "I don't care how many times you've seen it, you'll never watch it the same way again."
Yes, that's what I meant to say, I am just like Steven Spielberg.
Lee. Yep.
Thank you.
No, it's
so
funny.
Much.
Exactly. It's like the pain when you're a fan of something, you pick up a book and you read it, and the person who wrote it wasn't as big a fan as you, right? So there's usually only one piece of new information in a book you picked out, right? The only comparison I can really make to this, it's like the Get Back documentary about the Beatles, where it really changes how you, that changes how you viewed the Beatles. Everything you kind of were like, oh, I know about the Beatles. They did this. And these are the five facts I've heard regurgitated. To read this book, it is, it's on the equivalent of something that, it's a pivot point in how people see Stanley Kubrick. It's going to really, when this comes out and everybody gets on their hands on it, all these people who've written about The Shining are going to have to be like, okay, bye.
Well, it was very kind of you to say thank you. It's like, I'm like, that really means a lot to me because that was the book I tried to make. To your point, right now, only 1,000 people in the world get to see this book and read this book because it's only out in a collector's edition. But I'm hoping by the end of next year, we'll have an affordable version of it for the masses and everyone will get to read this. And I hope you'll throw this back into your podcast feed again when the trade edition comes out so that people can hear about it and actually go buy the book.
Oh, absolutely.
It's very difficult for people to do.
We'll
right
be talking
now
about it for a long time to come, but we've said this on the podcast before, even though, of course, it's very expensive, I can't tell you how worth it it is. For one thing, it's Toshin, so it's an investment. These things go up. But the knowledge in this book, with all these bookmarks I have here, if you just put, I don't know, $5 on each bookmark, every little bit of trivia, you'd pay for it. I would pay $5 for each one of these little factoids, and it adds up to the amount. It's worth it. And
yeah, you got to send me a picture of that.
Okay.
That's so awesome.
I will. Lee, thank you so much for doing this with us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. Yeah, really great to do it. And I'm glad you love it so much. Thank you.
Thank
it means
you
a lot.
Thanks.
For more Gourley and Rust content, head over to patreon.com/withGourleyandRust to get episodes ad-free and a whole week early. Plus, monthly mailbag episodes and feature-length watch-along film commentaries of your favorite horror classics. That's patreon.com/withGourleyandRust. Email us at withGourleyandRust@gmail.com, and your questions might be featured on a future mailbag episode. With Gourley and Rust theme song by me, Matt Wood, and performed by Townland. You can find us on Instagram as Townland Band, as well as Paul's fantastic band at Don't Stop or We'll Die. And why not rate and review With Gourley and Rust on Apple Podcasts? It'll help us grow the show and keep us trucking through the Jasons and the Michaels, the Leatherfaces and the Chuckies, the aliens and the Candymans.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.